From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today begins the 40th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which brought us to the brink of nuclear war with the Soviet Union. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with historian Arthur Schlesinger, who was a special assistant to President Kennedy during the crisis, and with Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive, which worked to declassify top-secret documents about the crisis that reveal what happened behind the scenes. Kornbluh was one of the organizers of the 40th anniversary conference that was held last weekend in Cuba. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Quentin's, the new novel by Maeve Binchy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush signed a congressional resolution today giving him authority to use military force against Iraq, and he put pressure on the UN to pass its own resolution backing international military action. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
On a day when the UN was debating the issue of confronting Iraq, the president described himself as a patient man. Russia, France, and China, all countries with veto power on the UN Security Council, oppose using military force in Iraq. The president says U.S. diplomats are trying to build a consensus and that he's willing to work with the UN.
And if the UN can't act, however, if they're unable to act, if once again, after 11 years and 16 resolutions, they cannot bring themselves together to disarm Saddam Hussein, then we will lead a coalition to do just that.
The president did not, though, put a timeline on when he expects the UN to pass a resolution. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
The Senate has approved a $355 billion defense spending bill that gives President Bush most of what he requested. The record spending plan increases spending by more than $37 billion over last year. The measure includes a 4% pay raise for all U.S. military personnel. Police say they still don't have enough details to release a composite sketch of the Washington-area sniper. Witnesses apparently have given conflicting descriptions of what the person believed responsible for 9 deaths over the past 2 weeks. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Police say one witness did see the sniper firing at the last victim, a woman killed in Falls Church, Virginia. Police say the witness described an AK-74 as the weapon, but police do not have enough confidence in the physical description of the shooter to release a sketch or to give details about the suspect they're looking for. Montgomery County Police Captain Nancy Demme asked for more help from the public. She urged people to think about whether they know someone who's been missing during the shootings.
That person has to be unaccounted for by everyone at that time, assuming they're acting alone, and we do.
Witnesses saw a light-colored van with a ladder rack leaving the scene. Police are looking through vehicle registration records based on tag information from witnesses. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
A federal judge in Houston has sentenced the Arthur Anderson accounting firm to 5 years probation and a $500,000 fine for obstructing justice in the Enron case. The penalties are the maximum allowed. Anderson executives admitted to shredding thousands of Enron-related documents and deleting computer messages stemming from its audits of the bankrupt energy firm. Anderson has now stopped auditing public companies and operates with fewer than 1,000 of its former payroll of 28,000. In stocks, the Dow lost 219 points to close at 8,036. The Nasdaq lost 50 points to close at 1,232. This is NPR News. Despite swinging to a third-quarter profit, New Jersey-based Honeywell International plans to cut as much as 5% of its workforce in the current quarter. Doug Doyle reports from member station WBGO.
Honeywell's chairman says his company will cut 3,000 to 5,000 jobs. The diversified high-tech manufacturer's cost-cutting efforts helped turn a modest profit in the third quarter, but net sales fell 4% as its key aviation business battled slack demand from airline customers. The maker of aerospace and automotive products and control systems for buildings and industry says it had a net income of 50 cents per share. That matches the consensus forecast of analysts surveyed by Thomson First Call. Honeywell last month cut its quarterly and full-year earnings forecast, saying it did not see a broad economic recovery materializing. The chairman says many of their commercial airline customers are struggling financially and, as a result, are reducing capacity and spending on non-critical maintenance and upgrades. For NPR News, I'm Doug Doyle in Newark.
The agencies that control water distribution in Southern California have come up with a tentative agreement that would channel more water from the Colorado River into the fast-growing urban area around San Diego. Farmers in the Imperial Valley agreed to give up about 2% of the river water they're now using to irrigate crops in the desert. That water would go instead to the 3 million people in and around San Diego. The plan calls for the farmers to leave some of their acreage unplanted. The agreement is part of an overall effort to reduce California's use of the Colorado River, which it shares with Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today begins the 40th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which brought us to the brink of nuclear war. On October 16, 1962, President Kennedy was informed that CIA aerial spy photos revealed Soviet missiles had been secretly moved into Cuba, missiles with a far enough range to strike the United States. For the next 13 days, we moved closer to confrontation until the Soviets agreed to withdraw the missiles. On the seventh day of the crisis, President Kennedy told the American public about the missiles. Here's a brief excerpt of his speech.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. The characteristic of these new missile sites indicate two distinct types of installations. Several of them include medium-range ballistic missiles capable of carrying a nuclear warhead for a distance of more than 1,000 nautical miles. Each of these missiles, in short, is capable of striking Washington, D.C., the Panama Canal, Cape Canaveral, Mexico City, or any other city in the southeastern part of the United States. To halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. I have directed the continued and increased close surveillance of Cuba and its military buildup. Should these offensive military preparations continue, thus increasing the threat to the hemisphere, further action will be justified. I have directed the armed forces to prepare for any eventualities. It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union. Finally, I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace and to stable relations between our two nations. I call upon him further to abandon this course of world domination and to join in an historic effort to end the perilous arms race and to transform the history of man.
This past weekend, surviving members of the Kennedy and Khrushchev administrations, as well as Fidel Castro himself, met in Cuba for a conference marking the 40th anniversary of the missile crisis. Part of the agenda was discussing recently declassified top-secret documents that help explain what really happened behind the scenes. The conference was organized by Cuban institutions and the National Security Archive at George Washington University, a group that works to declassify historically important documents. My guest Peter Kornbluh directs the archive's Cuba Project and edited a book of declassified documents published on the 30th anniversary of the crisis. Also with us is historian Arthur Schlesinger. He was a special assistant to President Kennedy throughout his administration. I asked Peter Kornbluh to describe the missile crisis.
It didn't just start in October of 1962. The context of the crisis was a protracted U.S. Hostility towards Cuba, starting really in late 1959, almost a year after Castro's revolution, when the CIA first wrote memorandums suggesting that Castro and Che Guevara and other Cuban leaders should be assassinated, obviously escalating with the Bay of Pigs invasion in April of 1961, and continuing with covert operations like Operation Mongoose, which was a massive effort to destabilize and undermine Castro revolution. This led to a threat perception, and not an unreal one in Cuba, that they needed support from the Soviet Union in terms of military aid and in terms of a military guarantee. The Soviet Union had its own interests. It faced U.S. missiles positioned in Italy and Turkey. It saw Castro as an ally in the Caribbean and Latin America. And in May of 1962, under the guise of an agricultural delegation, Nikita Khrushchev, the premier of the Soviet Union, sent a nuclear delegation to Cuba and suggested that one way to guarantee Cuba's safety would be to install missiles on the island. I think Arthur could certainly describe events from there, but the United States did not discover these missiles until October 15th, 1962, when aerial photography taken by a U-2 reconnaissance plane was interpreted, and the evidence came from these photographs that there were these installations being rapidly built. John Kennedy spent almost a week, 6 days, deliberating in secret what to do about this, finally decided to, rather than invade Cuba, as many of his military advisors wanted him to do, to give the Soviets some time to negotiate on this and to find a solution without an invasion, without a preemptive strike, and imposed a naval quarantine to stop Soviet ships from coming to Cuba with further nuclear equipment. That speech he gave to the nation on October 22nd, over the course of the next 6 days, it was extremely tense. On October 27th, the most dangerous day, a U-2 reconnaissance plane was shot down over Cuba by a Soviet battery. There was an extraordinary exchange between U.S. ships and Soviet submarines that were carrying nuclear-tipped torpedoes. It wasn't clear in the White House whether Khrushchev really wanted a solution on that day, and things seemed to be escalating out of control. By the 28th, it appeared both leaders were ready to come to an agreement. Khrushchev actually did announce that he would pull the missiles out.
Arthur Schlesinger, you were advising President Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I'm going to ask you if you could choose one of the documents that was recently declassified and tell us if there's something that you learned that even you didn't know at the time.
I think the role of Cuba deserves a certain amount of emphasis, particularly because the meeting took place in Havana, and Fidel Castro is the only man, chief of state, who's still involved in the crisis, who is still around. Castro did not want to accept the missiles. He felt that this would make Cuba a strategic target. It would complicate Cuba's relationship with other countries in the Western Hemisphere. He would welcome Soviet troops. He would even welcome membership in the Warsaw Pact, but he didn't want the missiles. As Khrushchev put it in his own memoirs, we argued and argued, and finally Fidel gave in. Castro then proposed that the transaction be made public. There is no reason under international law why the Soviet Union should not send nuclear missiles to Cuba. However, Khrushchev believed in the secrecy. He sent emissaries, sent messages, lying messages, denying that the Soviet Union was sending offensive missiles, offensive arms to Cuba. And the stealth and deceit which accompanied the Soviet deployment of missiles in Cuba gave a moral advantage to the United States.
Did you not realize at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis that Cuba didn't want those missiles?
We did not realize that. We assumed that Castro welcomed the missiles as a means of deterring a U.S. invasion. This recent conference gave much greater emphasis than the previous conference and the previous understanding to the real tension, the friction between Cuba and the Soviet Union. In fact, Castro seemed madder at Khrushchev last week than he seemed mad at Kennedy. Having accepted the missiles on the terms of socialist solidarity, he was appalled that Khrushchev had neglected to inform him of the withdrawal of the missiles. Castro himself heard that over the radio. And having made this great sacrifice because of the Russian avowals of the solidarity of the socialist bloc, the solidarity did not extend to consultation or even notification of the withdrawal of the missiles. He was furious.
Peter Kornbluh, what's one of the recently declassified documents that makes you see the story in a slightly different light?
It's impossible, Terry, out of several thousand documents that we brought to Cuba to identify any single one. But let me just say that there were a series of Russian documents that recorded conversations between Castro and Soviet emissaries, particularly Anastas Mikoyan, who Khrushchev sent to Cuba in early November to try and mollify Castro, who was, as Arthur Schlesinger just said, extremely angry about what Khrushchev had done in withdrawing the missiles. And we now have the actual record of their conversations over a 2 or 3 week period, which really, I think, show beyond shadow of a doubt that Cuba was never a client state of the Soviet Union. Cuba was never a client state of the Soviet Union. It disagreed very forcefully on the decisions during the missile crisis. It disagreed very forcefully on other Soviet positions regarding revolution in Latin America, economic planning, etc. And at this conference last week, he certainly detailed meetings with the Soviets in a way that we had never heard before. And now we have documents that actually record his conversations with Soviet emissaries as well. We have many, many other documents. We have Soviet orders on various missile deployments, on various missile withdrawals. We have declassified Cuban documents that the Cuban government itself located, reviewed, and released for this conference that contained information on Castro's military strategy in the face of what he thought was an imminent U.S. invasion, on his efforts to shoot down low-level reconnaissance planes that were flying at what he called grass-cutting altitude.
Peter, you presented one document which startled all the Kennedy advisors around. That was a document showing President Kennedy's effort to use Brazil as a mediator, to communicate a message to Castro. That shows how, to the extent to which President Kennedy was prepared to go to avoid conflict, armed conflict. But the Secretary of Defense McNamara, Ted Sorensen, Dick Goodwin, and I had never heard, or if we had ever heard of this effort on Kennedy's part, we had forgotten about it.
Terry, there was one set of documents on the so-called Brazil Initiative that have been unearthed by my colleague James Hirschberg at George Washington University. And these included a message that Dean Rusk, Secretary of State, passed to Kennedy and got his authorization to secretly give to the Brazilians. The idea was to create a direct channel between the United States and Fidel Castro during the missile crisis. Kennedy feared any revelation that he was actually trying to communicate directly with Castro, so he authorized this U.S. message to be given to the Brazilians on the grounds that the Brazilians would present it as a message of theirs, a Brazilian message. And we were able, James Hertzberg was able to find the actual text of the message. For the first time, he read this message to Fidel Castro because, in fact, by the time the Brazilians got to Havana with the message, Khrushchev had decided to withdraw the missiles and announce this, events had superseded the message itself. But we now have the message. We now know, as Arthur Schlesinger said, the efforts that John Kennedy was making to avoid a preemptive strike, avoid the unforeseen circumstances that could come from invading Cuba while nuclear weapons were poised to be shot.
My guests are Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive and historian Arthur Schlesinger, who was an advisor to President Kennedy. More on the Cuban Missile Crisis after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the 40th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Let's pick up where we left off with historian Arthur Schlesinger, who was a special assistant to President Kennedy. How afraid were you during the Cuban Missile Crisis? And I'm wondering if you and other members of the Kennedy administration were telling their families to leave town. Were you telling your families at all anything that was happening behind the scenes? Were you sharing your fears once you realized how frightening the scenario was?
We were receiving evacuation notices, those of members of the White House staff, for example. But I think the general feeling was expressed by Robert Kennedy when he said that he was damned if he was going to abandon his wife and children, and that he would confront any crisis with his family. I think that's the way most of us felt.
So you were being advised to evacuate Washington and leave your families behind?
No, in case of war, we had evacuation instructions where to go.
To go to a safe place so that you could keep planning.
As they now say, a safe, undisclosed location.
Right.
Where the vice president seems to be spending most of his time.
How close do you think we came to nuclear war? And is there one thing that you could put your finger on that you would isolate as having averted nuclear war?
I think the one thing that averted nuclear war was the understanding on the part of Khrushchev that he would lose the war. He was not a leader. He was a gambler, a plunger, but he didn't want to commit suicide. So I think looking back, he was bound to withdraw the missiles. We did not know at the time how clearly he saw the situation. But I think the great fear on Kennedy's part, and probably on Khrushchev's part too, also, was not that either country, either of these great powers would deliberately initiate nuclear war, but it was that something would go badly wrong down the line somewhere. The Dr. Strangelove situation, where the crazy general decided on his own to launch a missile, and so on. It was that where the issues of command and control were very much in Kennedy's mind, and in Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara's mind, too.
Arthur Schlesinger, if you could give any advice to President Bush now, as he leads us toward a possible war in Iraq, what would that advice be?
Well, I would advise him to continue the processes of containment and deterrence, which have kept Saddam Hussein behind its borders for a decade, that he return the inspectors with a strong team of inspectors, calling Saddam Hussein's bluff on unconditional inspection. I would think that Saddam Hussein is a monster. He has undoubtedly been building a ghastly arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. but he will not use them because if he commits an act of aggression, that provides the American government with the pretext for massive retaliation. He will only use his ghastly arsenal of weapons of mass destruction when we invade Iraq.
In the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Kennedy administration wasn't negotiating directly with Cuba. They were talking with Russia and with Khrushchev and Khrushchev's men. And, you know, there was a long standoff between the United States and the Soviet Union, and I think both of the superpowers understood what was at stake, perhaps a little better than Castro did. In the case of Iraq, we're negotiating directly with Saddam Hussein. Do you think that that we're in a different position negotiating directly with Saddam Hussein than, say, Kennedy was negotiating with a superpower like Russia?
Yes, I do think we're in a very different situation, and it's therefore more problematic. But Saddam Hussein isn't immortal. To try to anticipate the cunning of history takes, it's like the Steven Spielberg movie, Minority Report, about the precogs who were psychically equipped to foretell crimes that are about to be committed in time to avert those crimes. So far as I can see, Donald Rumsfeld Vice President Cheney see themselves as precogs. They know the future. Well, history is filled with surprises and outwits all our certitudes. And for us to assume a foreknowledge of the future seems to me a gross act of delusion.
Well, Arthur Schlesinger, I'm going to let you go. I know you have a busy day ahead of you. So I want to thank you for talking with us about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Thank you, and I will award plenipotentiary powers to Peter Kornbluh.
Peter Kornbluh will remain with us, and Peter Kornbluh directs the National Security Archives Cuba Project, and he was one of the organizers of the 40th anniversary conference of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which took place in Cuba this past weekend. And Arthur Schlesinger, before you go, let me wish you a happy 85th birthday.
Thank you.
Historian Arthur Schlesinger was a special assistant to President Kennedy. More with Peter Kornbluh on the Cuban Missile Crisis in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Sabes bien que yo te quiero, sabes bien que yo te adoro, sabes bien que ya no puedo vivir sin ti. Yeah. Sabes bien que yo te he dado un amor puro y sincero, y aún así sigues creyendo que no te quiero.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Aveda, maker of earth-sensitive hair, body, and lifestyle products, and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on how nuclear war was averted during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We continue our conversation with Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Quentin's, the new novel by Maeve Binchy.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Cuban Missile Crisis began 40 years ago today when President Kennedy was informed that CIA photos revealed Soviet missiles had been secretly moved into Cuba. My guest, Peter Kornbluh, directs the Cuba Project of the National Security Archive. Using the Freedom of Information Act, he has worked to declassify top-secret documents that reveal what went on behind the scenes during the crisis. And he helped organize the 40th anniversary conference that was held last weekend in Cuba. Peter Kornbluh, now that there's so much debate within the United States about Iraq and whether we should go to war with Iraq or not, I'd like to compare that to what happened within the CIA and the military and the Kennedy administration during the Cuban Missile Crisis. What kind of debate was there between people who wanted to launch an attack or a preemptive attack and the more cautious point of view?
Well, the first factor of the Cuban Missile Crisis history that really is, I think, can illuminate the public policy debate over Iraq is the issue of intelligence failures. The CIA went back and forth for almost 2 months in August and September about whether the intelligence it was gathering showed that missiles were coming to Cuba. And there was a significant intelligence failure during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Even by the end of the crisis, the CIA had only identified 30 of the 42 missiles that were actually there. And so intelligence itself is fallible on both sides. It can underestimate the degree of danger. It can overestimate the degree of danger. The second factor of the Cuban Missile Crisis was the decision by the president to present the concrete evidence that he had to the public, to the international community at the United Nations, and to the American public. Inside the administration, there was a significant debate, and I can actually read you the options paper that Theodore Sorensen drew up, where he evaluated the two options that President Kennedy was considering. And these two options were, one, a massive airstrike and then invasion of Cuba. And this was debated extensively behind the scenes with most of the military personnel and the Joint Chiefs of Staff advocating forcefully that the president go in there and try and wipe out all these installations. Kennedy actually asked the head of the U.S. Air Force, "Can you guarantee me that if I authorized an airstrike, we would get all the missiles?" And the general, the head of the Air Force said, "Mr. President, I cannot guarantee that we could get every one." And that, I think, helped convince Kennedy to move towards the second option he was considering, which was a quarantine, a massive naval blockade of Cuba to stop Soviet ships from continuing on and create some time for communications with the Soviet Union to organize the withdrawal of the missiles. And I think this document shows the commitment of the President of the United States to pick the option that provided him with the most flexibility, that did not set him on a course that could lead to unintended consequences when he knew the perils of launching these nuclear weapons, where things seemed to be spinning out of control, and where his main objective was to avoid an invasion and give the Soviet Union both incentive and time to withdraw the missiles and end this crisis peacefully. Kennedy's military advisors were saying, there's no reason to wait. You can't wait. If you wait, you will be in a more dangerous situation. For Kennedy, it was even more dangerous to go in there not knowing where the warheads were and not knowing whether we could actually get all of the missile installations destroyed. We might still face an operative missile in that case, and obviously with massive attacks on Cuba and the bloody loss of Soviet personnel in Cuba, Khrushchev would be under tremendous pressure by his own military advisors to fire whatever weapon systems he had ready to come to the United States.
As President Bush seems to lead us closer to war with Iraq, we face a big election coming up in November. Now, Kennedy, too, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, was facing a big elections in America. The crisis was in late October, with elections coming up in early November. Was there discussion within the Kennedy administration about how the crisis was going to affect the elections? In other words, was there a political slant on the strategy for handling the Cuban Missile Crisis?
you know, Terry, politics and that November congressional election come up in many forms in the midst of this crisis. In one form was Operation Mongoose, this comprehensive set of covert operations which was supposed to destabilize Cuba and create an atmosphere for an uprising, which, according to Edward Lansdale, who was the manager of Operation Mongoose, could then provide the catalyst and opportunity for a U.S. invasion. And he laid out a timetable when all of these covert efforts would come to fruition right before those elections in October of 1962. His timetable was drafted in February of 1962, and his aim was to inspire an invasion, a U.S. invasion of Cuba in October of 1962 in order to give some political benefit to the president for those November congressional elections. Khrushchev himself told Castro, "I'm going to put those missiles in secret into Cuba. I will come to Cuba in November after the congressional elections in the United States, and we will announce together that these missile installations are a fait accompli. Therefore, we won't affect those elections. We'll wait till they're over, and Kennedy will have less political pressure on him." In fact, your question that you just posed to me was asked by the Cuban delegation at this conference last week. They wanted to know if Kennedy was motivated by politics in his response to this crisis. And the president's advisors who were at this conference, Ted Sorensen, Arthur Schlesinger, and Robert McNamara, made it absolutely clear that Kennedy had told his staff, had told his advisors, that politics were not to enter into any calculation of how we should respond to this situation.
My guest is Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the 40th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. My guest, Peter Kornbluh, directs the Cuba Project of the National Security Archive. He helped organize the 40th anniversary conference in Cuba last weekend. Peter, what moment would you pinpoint as the moment that averted nuclear war?
We've obtained tremendous documentation and tremendous information about the Cuban Missile Crisis, particularly over the last 10 years. And one of the things that has come out from this information, this documentation, that is so important is the degree to which John F. Kennedy was determined not to launch a preemptive strike against Cuba. He actually opened three different channels to the Soviets to say to them behind the scenes, secretly, "We will actually withdraw our missiles in Turkey in exchange for you withdrawing the missiles in Cuba." We've obtained the declassification, finally, of the transcripts and of the actual tapes of his conversations with his aides. And at one point, the conversation of swapping these missiles came up, and his aides said to him, "You know, you can't do that to NATO. You'll undermine NATO. The Turks will be angry." And his response was, "Look, it's easy to be courageous before the blood has really been shed in Cuba. But what do I say later when somebody comes to me and says, you could have just traded those missiles in Turkey that are obsolete for the missiles in Cuba, and thousands, tens of thousands of people would have been spared. What would I say then?" Basically, his point was. And he thought ahead. He thought ahead of the consequences of the various options that he was examining and decided that it would be best to do everything in his possible to try and get a message directly to Castro, to send a secret message to the United Nations saying, if the United Nations proposes this swap as its own initiative, we will agree to it. We will never say that we initiated this swap, but we will agree to it if you propose it. And through two different emissaries to Khrushchev, he sent the message, we will take those missiles out of Turkey. If you take these missiles out of Cuba, we will not sign anything that says we're doing this. In 4 months, you have my word, it will be done. And I think that is a key thing. Khrushchev understood that things were spinning out of control, and he decided to withdraw the missiles. But John F. Kennedy gave him what he needed to save face, to say, I got something out of this. And that is, I think, why war was in the end averted.
During the Cuban Missile Crisis, the military was pushing for a preemptive strike, and the president didn't want to do that. Right now, it looks like high-placed people in the military and in the CIA have serious reservations about war with Iraq. But the president seems to be pushing forward with that. Can you compare those two situations?
Well, certainly President Bush has not proven to be a good student of the Cuban Missile Crisis. As Arthur Schlesinger put it recently, he would flunk him in history. But our hope with this conference, since it has such immediate relevance to the issues confronting U.S. policymakers and the American public today, and indeed the whole world, is that this history can inform the present. One of the things that Robert McNamara said that certainly resonates today is that, you know, policymakers are human beings and human beings are fallible, but there is no room for error in a nuclear world. You don't get a second chance to correct your mistakes once those weapons have been fired. As Richard Goodwin pointed out, the greater the risk, the more hesitant we need to be to act, the more prudent we need to be in deciding how we will move forward. And finally, you know, Fidel Castro himself spent considerable time talking about various lessons for Cuba. But one of the things he said that was important, and he said it very emphatically, war does not solve any problems. That was his position. That war has never solved significant problems in human history.
In some ways, Fidel Castro was in a very similar position that Saddam Hussein is in now. Saddam Hussein knows that the United States wants to overthrow him. Castro knew that we wanted to overthrow him. He knew that there were plots against him. I mean, you know, the Bay of Pigs was just a year before the Cuban Missile Crisis when we tried to invade Cuba to overthrow him. And there were plenty of other things in the works that the CIA had cooked up to overthrow Castro. And I wonder if, 40 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis, if you feel that you've come away with any insights about how somebody behaves when they know a country is preparing to overthrow them.
If Fidel Castro and his Cuban advisors, the rest of his government, firmly believed that the United States was preparing to invade Cuba again. And they had every reason to think that. There were assassination missions that they knew about. There was the actual paramilitary assault at the Bay of Pigs in April of 1961. There was Operation Mongoose that they were gathering intelligence on. They were capturing exile infiltrators who were telling them under interrogation about the plans that the United States had. There was the trade embargo, the diplomatic isolation at the OAS. There was everything they needed to firmly believe that the United States would not rest, that the Kennedy brothers were committed to the destruction of the Cuban Revolution. And one of the things that came out of this conference was an acknowledgement and an apology. Theodore Sorensen, who was one of Kennedy's closest advisors, actually apologized to Fidel Castro in the middle of this conference for the violent side of Operation Mongoose. And there was an acknowledgement by Robert McNamara that if he had been a Cuban, he would have thought that the United States was preparing once again to invade Cuba as well. And he basically said this, and it was extremely important. We, those of us who supported Operation Mongoose and other aggressive acts toward the Cuban government, even though the president was not going to invade Cuba, we did not think through the logical conclusion of our actions, the logical impact on the Cubans of these various covert operations, sabotage operations, and diplomatic and economic pressures. And that, I think, is so important. We must think through the consequences of our actions and look into the future, if we can, to what they've led to. Saddam Hussein has obviously been under intense pressure. I don't think Fidel Castro, by the way, and Saddam Hussein really bear any comparison as leaders. Cuba never sought weapons of mass destruction, never had control of them, and never used poison gas or other types of awful weapons on their enemies, and certainly never invaded any of their neighbors as Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait just 10 years ago. But certainly one of the lessons of the Cuban Missile Crisis and of all of U.S. the last 42 years of U.S. policy towards Cuba is that small countries like Cuba aren't going to just roll over like a dead dog. They are proud people. These are proud countries. They have their own histories, and they're just like we are, committed to defending their sovereignty, their independence, and their very existence. And Cuba, in the end, when the Soviets proposed these missiles, was ready to accept them, both for the solidarity of the socialist bloc and for the defense of Cuba. And Saddam Hussein, unfortunately, may be prepared to do all sorts of things to defend his country. And that is the unforeseen consequences, that is the unknown factor that must weigh heavily in future decisions in that region of the world.
Can you talk a little bit about what it's like to be in a room with Fidel Castro and the surviving members of the Kennedy administration, who nearly went to war against each other, nearly went to nuclear war against each other, and are now willing to read declassified documents and to talk through what actually happened and what the consequences were?
You know, history is not only about reevaluation. It's not only about lessons learned. It can also be a factor of reconciliation. It's an amazing experience to sit in a conference room with Fidel Castro and other members of his government on one side of the table, and members of the Kennedy administration, including members who actually suggested the assassination of that very Cuban leader 40 years ago, and have them talk to each other in an atmosphere of mutual respect, with a common intention of understanding this history better and leaving it behind us. The deep acrimony and hostility in U.S.-Cuban relations in the early 60s has now been aired and discussed. Issues of wrongdoing on the part of the Kennedy administration have been acknowledged. The Castro government itself has acknowledged its role in intervention in other parts of Latin America. This is the past. The future can be different, and I think that using the history to inform the future and putting the history behind us is a very important thing in U.S.-Cuban relations where there is still great conflict.
Peter Kornbluh, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure, Terry.
Peter Kornbluh directs the Cuba Project of the National Security Archive. Declassified documents pertaining to the crisis are on the National Security Archive website. Here's the record that was the number one hit during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight, for my monster from his slab began to rise. And suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. Whoa. From my laboratory in the castle east, whoa, to the master bedroom where the vampires feast, whoa, whoa, the ghouls all came from their humble abode, whoa, to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
Wow.
The zombies were having fun.
In a shoot,
the party had just begun.
In a shoot,
the guests included Wolfman,
in a shoot,
Dracula, and his son. The scene was rocking, all were digging the sounds. Igor on chains, backed by his baying hounds. The coffin bangers were about to arrive with their vocal group, the Crypt Kicker Five.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They played the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They played the MASH.
They played the Monster MASH.
That was Bobby Boris Pickett and the Crypt Kickers. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Maeve Binchy's new novel. This is Fresh Air. Best-selling Irish author Maeve Binchy has just published a new novel. It's called Quentins. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says Binchy is certainly no James Joyce, and that undeniable literary fact may be its own cause for celebration.
Here's what's always happened in the past when I've gotten my hands on a review copy of a new Maeve Binchy novel. I'd inhale the first few pages, maybe a chapter, immediately. Then duty called. I'd give the Binchy book pride of place on my nightstand, but during daylight hours, I'd read the books I had to review. I'd keep sneaking little visits back to Binchy's novel, but I'd never consider reviewing it. Binchy's fiction is an abiding guilty pleasure, not challenging enough to be considered literature, not nearly unselfconscious and awful enough, like Harold Robbins or Danielle Steele's books, to be reclaimed as kitsch. But this time round, I've decided to come clean, do the right thing, take Binchy out in public and not punish her, critically, for being the master storyteller she's all but universally acknowledged to be. After all, I owe her. Maeve Binchy's books have sat with me beside a lot of hospital beds, soothed my jitters during many an airplane flight. Hers are the perfect novels to read in tense and enervating times, and I mean that as a great compliment. Binchy's plots are complex enough that they lift me out of my world into hers, and she has enough of a sense of the meanness and sadness in everyday life that her characters and outlook don't repel by being saccharine. Tell me a story, we beg of our parents when we're kids, hoping to be transported out of the moment. Maybe it's because Binchy so generously answers that enduring yearning for a good story that I've critically diminished her for reducing me, a certified professor of literature, back to a rapt child. Binchy's latest book is called Quentins, and it's as good as she gets, which is very good indeed. I swear to you, teared up as I read the last page, the only fitting response, of course, to an Irish tale of wronged women, faithless men, martyred mothers, and kindly benefactors who saved the day with generous pots of euro dollars. Yet somehow, and this is where Binchy's storytelling magic enters in, she manages to make this well-worn material seem as fresh as a smock of Irish linen. To paraphrase one of Binchy's own characters, it's not a story full of shamrockery, the how are things in Glacamora top of the morning approach. There's nobody doing leprechaun duty in this novel. Quentins tells the tale of 40 or so years in the life of a fictitious famous restaurant by that same name in Dublin. Loyal readers will salivate at the news that Binchy is returning us back to the world of food, glorious food, a world she detailed in her last novel, Scarlet Feather. Tom Feather and Kathy Scarlet, the likable catering team from that book, perform a few walk-ons here, as do other familiar characters. The main narrative, though, focuses on a pretty young teacher named Ella Brady, who falls for a 40-ish, married-with-children financial consultant named Don Richardson. Don, Ella lectures herself after their first meeting, is a known charmer, a professional who made his money by saying, "Trust me," to people, by holding their hands for a little too long, by letting his eyes lock into theirs. Nevertheless, good girl Ella stumbles into his arms. Their first illicit lunch takes place at Quentin's. Months later, Ella waits, naively, for him at Quentin's again, after he's already fled the country, taxman at his heels. Shortly after, she begins waitressing at Quentin's to pay her parents back for the life savings they've lost by investing with Don. And that's not the half of it. Ella begins helping out on a documentary film that uses Quentin's as a focal point to chart the dynamic changes in the Irish economy and self-image, from watery soup and beans and toast to creme brulee and computer chips. Consequently, we hear the life stories in miniature of Quentin's chef, hostess, waitstaff, and scores of its customers. Binchy performs a flashy storytelling step dance here, keeping the main tale of Ella spinning while twirling around about 25 other brief but compelling narrative partners. This past weekend, I was at the National Book Festival here in Washington, and I found myself explaining Maeve Binchy's attractions to someone who'd never read her. She's the Irish Susan Isaacs, but a bit less comical, I heard myself say. This other woman nodded enthusiastically as her lip curled slightly in derision, mixed critical body language. Both Binchy and Isaacs fall into that somewhat disreputable book bin labeled Great Reads. They'll never be canonized, but they're beloved, and I suspect that both writers laugh about their exiled status all the way to the bank.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Quentin's by Maeve Binchy. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. Our executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of They All Laughed at Christopher Columbus, An Incurable Dreamer Builds the First Civilian Spaceship by Elizabeth Weil, available in hardcover, and the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Uncle Tungsten, Memories of a Chemical Boyhood by Oliver Sacks, author of Awakenings. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the sniper subculture. We talk with Tom Diaz of the Violence Policy Center about the guns, the websites, and the private sniper schools. Diaz has been following the emergence of the sniper subculture for several years. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.